Service safe.
Professor Buzzkill. Mininess.
Let me take you back to a significant year in world history, Buzzkillers. 1963. Many important and famous things happened in that year, and you know about most of them. The Beatles released their first album, Please Please Me, in March. The island prison at Alcatraz in California was closed. Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech during the March on Washington in August. And of course, the Kennedy assassination happened in late November. You should also know about two other crucial historical events from 1963. The first and most important, of course, was that the Duchess of Buzzkill gave birth in April to none other than your favorite professor and not-so-humble narrator. The second was the release of the now-classic World War II POW film, The Great Escape, which came out in June. And that's what we're going to talk about today. That famous story, that famous film, and the famous myths and misunderstandings generated by it. Now, buzzkillers of a certain age will get all misty-eyed when they remember growing up on those war pictures like The Great Escape. They all had fantastic all-star casts, snappy dialogue that we could all quote as naturally as if we'd written it ourselves, and carefully constructed sets and locations that created the visual images we had of what World War II must have looked like. And those movies set those images in our minds forever. That's right. Our generation had memes long before the millennial generation made the idea of memes a meme in itself. But there's another reason we're talking about The Great Escape in December, Buzzkillers. I had my second dose of that film, second big dose anyway of that film, during the many happy years I lived in England in the early 1990s. Watching The Great Escape on Christmas Day is a holiday tradition in the United Kingdom. Joining in on that tradition every year while I was a graduate student there brought back priceless memories of my childhood. So it's with a big shout out to the many thousands of British buzzkillers out there that we dig right into the history and mythology of that film. The Great Escape was a breakout from Stalag Luft III, a special POW camp built in the German province of Lower Silesia, which is roughly 100 miles southeast of Berlin. Two prominent POW escapes occurred there during the war. The first was the famous Wooden Horse escape in October 1943. British POWs used a wooden gymnastic vaulting horse as a cover for digging a tunnel. Three officers were able to escape through the resulting tunnel and make it back to Britain. This story was later told by one of the escapees, RAF Captain Eric Williams, in his book entitled The Wooden Horse, published in 1949. And it was one of a great many similar books that I pored over as a young buzzkiller. It was made into a movie in 1950, again, watched by yours truly. The other breakout from Stalag Luft III was the uber-famous Great Escape of March 1944. Planned by British squadron leader Roger Bushell and other high-ranking POWs in the camp, the Great Escape was based around the construction of three tunnels named Tom, Dick, and Harry, so that if one of those tunnels collapsed or was discovered by the German guards, the Allied prisoners could still escape through one of the other two. But tunneling was a problem because the Luftwaffe had chosen the location for Stalag Luft III based on the sandy soil in the region, which would be very difficult to tunnel through and, of course, shore up so that the tunnels wouldn't collapse in on you as you're trying to get out. Not only that, secretly disposing of the dug-up sandy soil was a huge logistical problem, especially since it was very difficult to disguise and to hide it, and there's no place to put it, practically. And creating other things like enough civilian clothes, documents, passes, and 1,000 other small details involved in such a huge escape was an enormous problem. Bushell and his crew were up against some formidable obstacles. And let's not forget, buzzkillers, you know, in late 43, early 44, the Luftwaffe had already lived through the Wooden Horse breakout, and they'd specifically built this camp to prevent POWs with escape mania from doing just that, escaping. So to say that the Germans were on high alert all the time at the camp and that any big escape was likely to fail is a major understatement. But Roger Bushell convinced many of his fellow officers and POWs that by getting out as many men of the camp as they could and having them on the run, the Germans would have to divert great numbers of soldiers and enormous other resources, police, people like that, chasing them. And even if all the escapees were eventually recaptured, Bushill argued. That diversion alone, that hassle alone, would hurt the overall German war effort. So, on the night of the 24th and 25th of March 1944, 76 Allied POWs escaped the camp and tried to make their way to the safety of Allied lines or neutral countries or even back to Britain itself. Most of the escapees didn't make it very far. Their forged papers were often incorrect or flawed or outdated and were recognized as fakes almost immediately by various authorities, even low-level authorities, ticket clerks and things like that, at railway stations or at roadblocks. Bad weather made the escape attempt harder as the colors in some of the POWs' dyed civilian suits began to run in the rain, as in the bad weather made traveling by foot difficult generally. 73 of the great escapers were caught and rounded up within 2 or 3 days. Three POWs were able to make it all the way to freedom. Per Bergsland and Jens Müller, both Norwegian pilots who were serving in the RAF, eventually got to neutral Sweden by boat. Having made it all the way to the Baltic coastline in the north of Europe and sneaking on board a freighter. Bram van der Stok, a Dutch pilot in the RAF, made it by hook or crook somehow all the way to neutral Spain. And from there, he was able to get back to Britain, where he rejoined the RAF and kept fighting. This, by the way, van der Stok's fighting, included taking part in Operation Overlord, the codename for D-Day and the Battle of Normandy, as well as taking part in air raids against German V-1 rocket bases in the Low Countries. He was the most decorated aviator in Dutch history by the end of the war. But the story of the 73 captured POWs was quite different. 13 were returned to the camp, but Hitler himself had been informed of the escape and was really infuriated by it. He ordered 50 of the captured men to be executed. Since these airmen had been captured and therefore had surrendered, their execution was in violation of military tradition, it was in violation of the Geneva Convention, and was considered murder. This disturbing fact is very directly pointed out in the movie. So how did the story of the Great Escape make it to our movie screens and television sets, and how did it prove so endlessly popular? Paul Brickhill, an Australian fighter pilot who had served as a prisoner in Stalag Luft 3, wrote his account of the breakout, and it was published as a book in 1950. Brickhill had been involved in the planning of the escape and served as a decoy for the camp guards, but he didn't escape himself. His Great Escape memoir became a bestseller and was the basis for the 1963 film. Now, although almost all of it was filmed in Germany, the film version of The Great Escape was a Hollywood production, directed by John Sturges, one of the biggest Hollywood directors at the time. It had an all-star cast of famous British and American actors. Steve McQueen played a fictional American pilot who was obsessed with escaping. James Garner, another American actor, portrayed a Canadian officer and a specialist in the acquisition of necessary materials. I'm putting acquisition in air quotes there. Richard Attenborough was the escape leader, Roger Bartlett, based on Roger Bushell, the real leader. James Donald, a greatly underappreciated actor, played the senior British officer. And the specialist forger who went blind, straining his eyes, was played by Donald, take me with you, I can see perfectly, Pleasance. And finally, James Coburn was cast as an Australian combat pilot, despite having a hilariously bad and unconvincing Australian accent. And the film tells the basic story of the immense difficulties of planning the escape, digging the tunnels, fooling the Germans, and the story of the actual breakout itself pretty well. And it does it with almost perfectly paced drama, with great sets and visual production, as I mentioned earlier, and good, you know, if somewhat stilted, dialogue. And apart from the standard Hollywood practices of merging historical characters to make the central number of cast characters more manageable for viewers, more believable, and simplifying some of the other complications of the story, it's a fairly straightforward account of the escape. Okay, so far so good. And you buskillers know that it's institute policy that we don't expect movies to be historically accurate or not pinpoint accurate. They're works of fiction. And the responsibility of writers and directors is to make quality movies, quality works of fiction. And The Great Escape is definitely that. As with many other iconic history movies, especially World War II movies, however, important historical issues and questions are mythologized, and facts are fabricated in The Great Escape. That's a problem for historians because the public's perception of what actually happened at Stalag Luft 3 are skewed in the process. Fortunately, Buzzkill Institute historians have consulted a wide range of excellent historical work dealing with World War II in general and the Great Escape in particular. For instance, we've relied heavily on the work of Guy Walters, an expert on the Nazi era and World War II. His book, The Real Great Escape, is absolutely the best work on the subject and is our featured title on the Buzzkill bookshelf this week. While lots of research by lots of military historians has exposed the myths and misconceptions about the Great Escape, Walters brings it all together and provides much new research and analysis of his own. So this episode, Buzzkillers, is greatly indebted to his work. So let's get to the myths and the misconceptions and the damage that they've done. One of the strongest Great Escape myths that's been reinforced by the movie is that Allied prisoners of war, especially officers, had a, quote, sworn duty to try to escape from POW camps. The senior British officer in the movie repeatedly states this in his meeting with the camp commandant. He repeatedly says that officers could not forget their duty to escape, which certainly gives the impression that the RAF pilots in Stalag Luft 3 were more or less under constant orders from the British High Command to escape. In fact, there was nothing in the British military rules, the famous King's Regulations, that said that captured soldiers were required to escape, officers or enlisted men, or to make their captors' jobs more difficult by continually trying to escape. Indeed, American soldiers were not under orders, standing orders, to try to escape from POW camps until the Korean War. But this myth about being required to escape, that was your duty to escape, became so strong that many veteran POWs from World War II misremember that this was a strict part of their duty. The duty to escape was more of an informal tradition, but it certainly wasn't followed by everyone. It's clear from the scholarly research done on Stalag Luft 3 that roughly 60% of the POWs not only refused to participate in escape attempts, some even tried to tell the guards where the tunnels were being dug. Among other things, these POWs didn't want to suffer the repercussions of being caught escaping. POW life was difficult enough as it was, and escaping for them wasn't worth the risk. Still, escape leader Roger Bushell and his close comrades were determined to get out, and Bushell famously kept urging that an escape would cause disruption in the German war effort. The Nazis would spend so much time rounding up escaped POWs that any massive escape attempt would be the same as opening up a new front inside Germany. This, he argued, would help win the war. And not only was this not true, Buzzkillers, it had exactly the opposite effect. In the first place, it was relatively easy to capture the Stalag Luft 3 escapees. Most didn't get very far at all, and local army and police units caught them easily and quickly because of the poor documentation they had with them. We now know that no extra German forces or resources were turned away from pressing war tasks and diverted to capturing POWs. The standard German police and military infrastructure in that region was sufficient. It worked. Secondly, the alert to be on the lookout for POWs from Stalag Luft 3 and the manhunts raised to capture the Allied prisoners ended up capturing a lot of other POWs, other escaped prisoners from civilian jails, foreign workers who had escaped and run away from their employers, and other criminals. If anything, the Great Escape made the German security net tighter and made it even more difficult for others held against their will by the Nazis to escape. And this is perhaps the most troubling aspect of the mythology of the Great Escape, the idea that mass escape attempts were an effective form of attack against the enemy because of the disruption they caused. The strength with which these myths are held tends to whitewash the real moral qualms that military leaders had long had about encouraging things that would almost certainly fail and lead to more death. The top ranks of military brass in Britain had known since World War I, almost 20 years before, that mass POW escape attempts were usually fruitless, they're very counterproductive in terms of tying up enemy men and resources, and they ultimately resulted in more deaths of Allied personnel. Consequently, they did not encourage such wide-eyed escape plans in World War II. Some zealous junior officers, such as Roger Bushell, who were tragically convinced by their own misconceptions about how extensive the impact of escape attempts, even failed ones, could be, were able to convince many others that they must try to escape as part of continuing to fight the war. This myth-busting is, of course, not intended to ridicule or disrespect the real bravery and the fantastic heroism of those who fought in World War II and those POWs who tried to escape. Unless we've been in that type of situation, none of us should pass judgment on the decisions they made or the actions they took. Neither should we pass judgment on the POWs who refused to take part in suicidal escape attempts. Buzzkill Institute historians are in no position to diagnose Roger Bushell as crazy and dangerous, and nor should we tar non-escapees with the brush of cowardice. I think, however, we can all agree that we must try to analyze the realities of war and the immense difficulties in making decisions about what risks to take during war as soberly as possible. We should do so without resorting to easy conclusions based on what we think happened because of what we've seen in Hollywood movies. But I'm like everyone else in my generation, Buzzkillers. My dad gave me books like The Wooden Horse and The Great Escape, and I devoured them. I watched the movies, especially The Great Escape. I used to play war with my friends, yelling out things like, "Take that, you rotten Jerrys," while pretending to machine gun Wehrmacht troops who were massing in our neighbor's backyard. And we all took turns playing Steve McQueen on his motorcycle, evading squadrons of Germans by pedaling our bikes as vigorously as we could and jumping them over obstacles. That's the kind of especially strong grip that films like The Great Escape had on the imagination of young boys. And that's the thing we're trying to stress here about history and movies. We can appreciate movies as entertainment and as works of art. But when it comes to history and warfare, we need to have our big boy pants on and be clear-eyed and clear-headed when we examine war. That's especially true when we as citizens use our conceptions about history and the conduct of warfare in making political and electoral decisions about these terrible, terrible things. So it's with this in mind that I'll be doing what my dad did, showing The Great Escape to my 13-year-old son this Christmas. And he'll no doubt love it. It's a great movie. But I'm also going to give him a little moralizing speech along the lines of what I just said about the perceptions of the history of warfare. I'll be trying to plant a seed of critical inquiry in his young mind, trusting that he and his generation will think twice before making snap decisions about war. And they'll eventually examine the nature of war in a serious, adult, and non-romantic manner. God, I hope it works. Talk to you next week.